This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by Swinburne Astronomy Online, the world's longest-running online astronomy degree program. Visit astronomy.swin.edu.au for more information.
Astronomy Cast, episode 349, Mercury 7 Astronauts. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Kane. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, and the director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Fraser?
I'm doing really well, and I've got a new job that I thought I would announce here publicly in Astronomy Cast and among all the other things to try and get some publicity. We get to shamelessly self-promote things we do from time to time.
We do, and this is an awesome project.
This is a pretty awesome job. Yeah, so I have joined a company called HeroX, and HeroX is a offshoot of the XPRIZE. So, you know, we've talked about the XPRIZE before. This is the prize created by Peter Diamandis to offer that awarded $10 million to the first private spacecraft that reached 100 kilometers altitude twice. It was won by Scaled Composites, and they've gone on to come up with other X Prizes like the Tricorder X Prize and the Lunar X Prize, which I know you're doing some work with.
Yeah.
So what HeroX is it is sort of Kickstarter meets X Prize. And so the question is, can we take what worked with the XPRIZE and put it on the internet and let anybody come up with an XPRIZE style challenge, an incentive challenge? Can anybody raise the funds and pledge money together to create a prize? And then can anybody come together and compete to win the challenge? And if it's possible, then we're going to figure out how to do it. And so I am the new development manager for PureWax. And so I'm the person who is going to be sort of creating the features and functionality of the platform and trying to figure out how to make this go. And So if you are a fan of me, please, I beg you, come help me out. Come and help us make some challenges. Try and figure out some ideas like the XPRIZE, like the Tricorder XPRIZE, like the Lunar XPRIZE. What are some ideas that would benefit humanity or just make everyone's lives a little easier? And let's see if we can turn these into challenges and try and get them funded. So that's what we're doing. So it's herox.com. And now back to our regular show. but it's a total honor. I mean, Peter Diamandis, I'm a huge fan of Peter Diamandis and the XPRIZE and all the folks that are working on this. So it's kind of a dream come true to work on this project.
I want to see this succeed. So please,
yeah, me too,
go support
me too.
What he's doing.
That'd be awesome.
This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by 8th Light, Inc. 8th Light is an agile software development company. They craft beautiful applications that are durable and reliable. 8th Light provides disciplined software leadership on demand and shares its expertise to make your project better. For more information, visit them online at www.8thlight.com. Just remember, that's www.8thlight.com. Drop them a note. 8th Light, software is their craft.
All right, so before the Apollo program, there was the Gemini program. And before the Gemini came the Mercury program. 7 elite astronauts chosen from a pool of military test pilots. So how did NASA choose these original 7 men? And so I guess this is a continuation of our numerology collection, in which we look at things that have numbers in them.
That is true.
So then who were the Mercury 7?
The Mercury 7 were test pilots. Initially, there had been a NASA plan to do open competition for the first astronauts, but the president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, came out and said, no, it's not just anybody we want. We want the best. We want test pilots. Amusingly, they didn't want Chunk Yeager, but that's a different story that we're not going into today. And so the first place you look when you want test pilots back then was the military. And so then they looked at the military, which is full of tall, manly men who fly space, not spacecraft, fly aircraft doing amazing things. And they realize the Mercury spacecraft is kind of tiny. So then they add, okay, you need to be a test pilot. You need to be under 5'11" and you need to weigh less than 180 pounds. So that suddenly changes your demographic. Because if you think about it, 5'11" on 180 pounds is pretty thin.
I'm out.
Yeah. And well, are you taller than 5'11"?
Yeah.
Yeah.
6 feet.
Yeah. So it was, you now are down to tiny test pilots. And so then they said, okay, I have to be under age 40, which gets us out again.
Out.
You have to have a bachelor's degree or equivalent. So that one wasn't quite so bad,
also
given everything.
Out.
Well, okay, fine. You weren't allowed to be an astronaut.
All right.
1,500 hours flight time and qualified to fly jets.
Finally, something I can do.
Yes. So they put out an advertisement and got hundreds and hundreds of applicants, which kind of leaves you going, how do we deal with this? This is a lot of people. So then they started searching military records because it wasn't just the application that mattered. So, yeah, you had to write a coherent application, but then they looked at what was your service, where did you serve, how did you serve. And I'm kind of intrigued that they tried really hard to grab people from all the services. So even the Marines, which wasn't known for its test pilots, had 5 candidates. You had 47 coming in from the Navy, 58 coming in from the Air Force. 69 of these came to Washington, D.C. And they brought them in 2 groups, or at least they planned to bring them in 2 groups, except the first group was so good that they kind of stopped. So then they tortured them.
I'm intrigued. How did they torture them?
So back then we had no idea what the human body would experience with weightlessness. We didn't know if people would be able to swallow in space. We didn't know anything, basically. We knew that people were going to be experiencing high G forces And so they did everything from spinning them in centrifuges to doing cold extreme tests by plunging their feet into ice water. They emptied them out in rather horrible medical ways using a grandmother torture device of enemas and castor oil. And so they did all sorts of stuff. And this was on top of the how athletic are you? Let's stick you on a treadmill forever and do oxygen readings. And let's tilt you and leave you slanted for a long period of time and see how you respond to that. So test after test after test after test.
It must have sucked. Like all of those blood tests like every couple of days. And all of the other stuff they had to do. Yeah, no, thank you.
And if you look at the timing for this, a lot of these were men who flew in World War II, who they'd been there, done that, hadn't always seen the best of conditions. And what really got me was looking at all the reasons that people originally got weeded out. So 6 somehow snuck in and turned out to be too tall. So that's the, I didn't know I was that height problem. That one's fairly dignified, at least. But then 33 just failed to be able to pass all of the exams. So this was rigorous, grueling, physiological testing that took place. And of those that survived it, 4 were like, I'm done. I'm out of here. Drop the mic, walk out of the room. And just weren't going to keep going. In the second round of testing they did of these poor individuals, 8 more people didn't make it through all of the exams. And so after all the exams were over, they had 18 people to interview, to basically do the media test, the education test, the IQ test. And they, from those 18, weeded it down to 7 men six of whom eventually flew into space on the Gemini program. And all of them were genius level IQ. All of them were Eagle Scouts, which I find the most amusing. And they were drawn from all of the different militaries. So we started out with one chimp and seven humans ready to fly into space. And the chimp and six humans were able to actually go up during Mercury. That last human eventually flew during the Apollo-Soyuz mission. And most of them flew more than once. But I think I'm jumping ahead of the story.
So who then were these people?
So they were a variety of different military men. As I said, they were drawn from all the different militaries. So we had three Air Force pilots, Gus Grissom, Cooper, Deke Slayton. There were three Navy pilots, Alan Shepard, Scott Carpenter, Shira. There was one Marine Corps pilot, John Glenn. It's kind of awesome given how few Marines started out in the testing that one Marine made it all the way through. I think that says something for Marines. And so these different men then proceeded to start training. And this was something where their wives were front and center. They were front and center. They ended up signing an agreement with Life magazine to have their life totally followed. And they realized what they were in for, but they also realized the opportunity they were being given. And so they pooled together, the wives supporting each other. They split all of the money from the media opportunities. They took care of each other for all the years of all of the missions. And unfortunately, we're at the point today where the only one left alive to still tell his story is John Glenn. But for a lot of years, many of these men rose through the different ranks of NASA and in cases like John Glenn's, even through the U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean, Gus Grissom, of course, lost his life during the Apollo 1 fire.
Right.
But the rest of them went on to move through from the Mercury program, many of them into the Gemini program and even into the Apollo program, right?
Yes. So Alan Shepard's the one that we all think about in terms of first American in space. This is an interesting series, the Project Mercury, because while it had a whole lot of American firsts, it didn't actually do anything that hadn't already been done. So we were still chasing on the heels of the Soviet Union at this point. So, of course, Ham the Chimp, who was a Project Mercury crew member, wasn't exactly one of the Mercury 7, but he did fly on the Mercury, and there were seven crewed Mercury missions. Just one of them was crewed by a chimpanzee.
One was chimp crewed. Yeah.
Yes, one was chimp crewed. So we start with Ham the Chimp, who was trained to move levers in space because there was a whole lot of concern that the poor fellow and poor humans later just wouldn't be able to think, to act, to do any. We had no idea what we were getting into. So he launched on what was called MR2 on January 31st, 1961. It was a suborbital flight, and he happily moved his levers, and his timing while he was going around the planet was only slightly slower, just like a second or so, than it was when he was on the ground. And well, if a chimp can deal with the chaos of suborbital flight and still do his tasks, it's pretty easy to imagine that a American military man who can fly test planes will be able to handle his controls. So we went from Ham the Chimp to then Alan Shepard. He went up. First launch for him was, unfortunately, his first launch and last launch for many, many years. Alan Shepard, a lot of people know the story of how he was waiting for launch. And before launch, he drank a whole lot of coffee, drank way too much coffee.
Right.
And they hadn't thought through the fact that he was going to get loaded up and they might not just kind of immediately take off. And they didn't. And So he eventually got permission to relieve himself of all of that coffee in his spacesuit. And one of the legends that's floating around, which isn't true, is that the reason he got grounded for so many years was because the urine in his spacesuit when he hit zero G got into his ears and caused ear problems that then grounded him. Well, I haven't heard anyone correct the notion that he did get pee in his ears. The real reason that he got grounded was he had a condition called Meniere's disease, which is an ear disorder, but it's not something that gets necessarily caused by pee in your ears.
Right.
So he got grounded for the rest of the Mercury flights. He was chief astronaut throughout the Gemini years. And they finally cleared him again to launch during the Apollo missions. And he was the commander of the Apollo 14 crew. So he got to go back and forth from launching May 5th, 1961 on Freedom 7, 15 minute suborbital, where he spent a whole lot longer waiting to launch. Then came down, took care of the other guys. He was that leader through the Gemini years. And then eventually finally got to fly again. So he has passed away. He died in 1998 at the age of 74. I personally find it greatly amusing that he lived out the rest of his life in Pebble Beach, which always makes me think of I Dream of Jeannie. So you do have the astronauts down there. And he's another New Englander like I am. He's originally from Derry, New Hampshire. And these early astronauts, they did kind of come from all over the United States.
So that was a response to, to Yuri Gagarin. And they didn't get a chance to actually orbit. It was a suborbital flight. It was a ballistic trajectory that he took. So it was still a little while before the Americans finally got someone to fully orbit the orbit.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Judy Grissom didn't do it after Shepard.
They were still launching on Redstone missiles. And I used the word missile on purpose. They called them rockets. They were missiles. So these weren't designed to go around the planet. These were designed to take out the Russians. And so Gus Grissom went up on Liberty Bell 7 in July of 1961, basically trying to do a quick turnaround, show what we're capable of. But while he went a little bit further, it was still a suborbital flight and just basically went up and down range and back down and rescued out of the ocean.
Of course, the sort of surprising thing about that mission, as you say, rescued out of the ocean, was his spacecraft. The hatch blew open and water filled up and it sank. And we only just recovered it, by we I mean NASA, just a few years ago.
And it was the recovery was paid for privately. And I think one of the reasons that people paid to recover it is Gus Grissom's career really got tarnished by rumor mongers after that, who claimed that he panicked and he blew the door. And there were people who said that there was no evidence of why the door would have blown on its own. And these aren't exactly cheap spacecraft. This is why so many of them landed in museums afterwards. And even after we rescued it, there was no clear evidence of why the hatch blew. So this is one of those mysteries that's just going to keep going and going and going. But he did get to go up again during the Gemini mission when Alan Shepard got grounded. Gus Grissom got swapped in to replace him on Gemini 3. So this time he got to do a multiple person launch. And since he was one of the tiniest astronauts, it was actually convenient to throw him on the itty bitty little tiny Gemini spacecraft. So there was that. But then unfortunately he died during the Apollo 1 testing, so he didn't even get to launch again. And that was just a horrific story that perhaps needs to be an episode of its own.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this unfortunate clustering of disasters that happened all around the same time. There's Apollo 1, there's the Challenger, and the Columbia, and they all happened within, you know, roughly the same
days.
Part of... Yeah, within
January.
Early February, late January, early February. So, right, so the next up then was John Glenn, and he went all the way around the Earth finally, and I guess that's because they upgraded his rocket. To a real rocket.
Yes, he finally got a real complete Atlas rocket to launch on. I feel comfortable calling it a rocket. It was not designed to bomb the Soviets. So he took off. He orbited the planet. He came back down. And then because he was really... kind of one of the most talkative, most outgoing of these early astronauts, he didn't end up flying again, but he did end up, well, at least not
on the
early missions. Yeah, yeah. He many, many, many years later, he went up in 98 when he was a congressman. But he took more of a backseat role and became a spokesperson for the Astronaut Corps, retired and went into politics and was a senator from Ohio for many years. I actually got to meet him when he was still a senator back in 1996, and that was pretty awesome. That's one of my highlights. But that was just kind of cool. He got to circle the globe, came back down safe. And sadly, after that, people kind of stopped remembering that these are still like all firsts in terms of what was able to happen. So you have Scott Carpenter, who, again, was someone who only got to go up once. He went up on the Aurora 7. All of these early Mercury missions had 7 this, 7 that.
That was because there were 7 astronauts, right?
And they
put that number at the end just to sort of celebrate the team.
Yes. And what was awesome about Carpenter is he went on to do oceanic research. So even though all of these men were... hired because they were excellent test pilots, he was someone who went on to have a separate career where he kept the science front and center, and that was kind of awesome. Yeah, he was.
Right.
He spent 5 hours in space. Kind of cool.
Now, one thing as well was that Carpenter replaced Deke Slayton, who had to step out.
Yeah, and that was one of the great sorrows is Deke Slayton. Somehow they missed that he had a heart murmur. So with all the testing and everything else they did, it wasn't until partway through the program that they caught on, oh no, this guy has a heart murmur. We don't know how rigorous space is going to be. So they grounded him for the entirety of what was left of the Mercury program, grounded him for the entirety of the Gemini program, grounded him for the part of the Apollo program that went to the moon and was sexy and exciting. And while he did a lot of good work, he was one of the NASA directors for the Astronaut Corps. It wasn't until the Apollo Soyuz missions, the docking missions between the Apollo spacecraft and the Soyuz spacecraft, that he finally got to go into space. So he retired in 82 and worked for Commercial Space Agency until he passed away. And so we're hitting the point where they're all slowly disappearing. So he died at age 69 in 1993.
Next up, Sigma 7 with Shira.
So we have Wally Schirra, whose last name I have to admit I struggle to remember. So his flight is sometimes classified as the one that went the most the way it was supposed to, which I find a fascinating way to describe a mission. So he went up, he was in space for 9 hours and 13 minutes and 11 seconds, and he ate and he drank and he orbited some more, and he came back and no one remembers him.
But this is where they were starting to, you know, work on these incremental developments, right? They, you know, the first one with Shepard and Grissom, they were only up for 15 minutes. They didn't even do a full orbit. They then for Glenn and Carpenter, they were up for three orbits. They were up for 4 hours. And then with Shira, he was there for 9 hours and he did six full orbits of the Earth. And then after that with Cooper, it was 22 orbits. And
Shira had a kind of awesome career, even if he does have the name no one remembers. He got to go back up during Gemini 6. He was assigned to command an Apollo mission. Unfortunately, because of the catastrophe with Apollo 1, he ended up getting promoted to the first manned flight, Apollo 7, and there was just chaos with a lot of his career, but he did end up going up with Apollo 7, and Shira was the one and only one to fly Mercury and Gemini and Apollo. So that's kind of neat.
And so that was the last mission was Cooper's, and I think he was the last surviving astronaut of that group as well, right?
Well, John Glenn's still alive.
Well, obviously for John Glenn, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It was, I guess, his last one. Yeah. He passed away in 2004.
No, Shira died in 2007.
No, I was talking about Cooper, Gordon Cooper.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. So skipping ahead to Gordon Cooper. So he flew up on Faith 7, which was May 1963. So he was into the second year of launching Americans into space. He was on just another, let's go up, let's orbit the planet. But he's known as the first human to sleep in space. And even at 34 hours, it's
there's
just
no
like,
way. I'd be too jazzed. There's no way I'd be sleeping. Yeah.
Heck, we do hangout-a-thons that long. So he's the person who is responsible for the phrase spam in a can, referring to being trapped in one of these things. He was part of Gemini 5. He commanded Gemini 5. And from there, he went on to corporate world. He did end up dying of heart failure, and he developed Parkinson's disease. So it's kind of how human these people were, even though we tout them up as superheroes. These were just people who had amazing brains and amazing flight skills, but they were still human. Unfortunately, for better or worse, Gordon Cooper is also known for his UFO experiences.
Right.
But I think we're just going to kind of brush right on past that one, maybe.
Right. So those were the, those were the manned and chimped.
Those were the Mercury, crude.
The crude Mercury missions. There's actually a whole bunch more unmanned ones. And a lot of like those classic rockets exploding, rockets going up and then coming back down. You know, that all happened. I think one number that sort of jumped out at me that's quite amazing was the budget was $1.73 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, today's money, which is kind of amazing that they did all that.
That's less than the cost of James Webb, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it involved the work of 2 million people. So unless I'm getting the numbers wrong. But it just shows that, you know, there was a time when NASA was very agile and could get these missions going and get step by step advancements moving from to send humans into space. So,
yeah.
Now, reference material. I think there's some really wonderful, wonderful reference material that people can go if they want to follow the story a little further. There's sort of two things that I love, and you know maybe you'll have some others. So the one is From the Earth to the Moon, which is based on the Andy Chaikin series book, and then they made this TV show called From the Earth to the Moon, and it was, I think, directed and produced by Tom Hanks, and it was on HBO, and yes, they're great, and they cover
miniseries.
Sort of, yeah, and so they cover, like, I think one episode or two episodes with the Mercury folks, and then onto the Geminis and onto the Apollos. Just wonderful. And then the actual book itself, From the Earth to the Moon, and then the other one, of course, is The Right Stuff, which is also a movie, and
it covers them. It goes into the whole thing that we skipped over, which was the whole, why isn't Chuck Yeager one of these?
Yeah, but it just goes into the personalities of the astronauts and just covers it with sort of humor and wit and really great. So either the movie or the book definitely
or both. Goes up.
Or both, yeah. Yeah, but if you want to, like, have a full understanding of that time, you know, if you read From the Earth to the Moon and Write Stuff, you'll have a really good understanding of it.
And it's really amazing to compare what they looked for then with what they look for today, because now they're looking at interdisciplinary degrees, fluency in Russian, you need to be medical trained, you need to be flight trained, you need, and they've just upped the ante so much. You no longer need to be a military test pilot, but in some ways I think that was easier because at least you knew where the bar was.
Yeah. I don't know if I could be an astronaut now. Probably, you know, because they will let, like, regular schmoes come on board if they have some specific skill they need. So,
yeah.
So mission maybe they specialists. Need a podcaster for their next mission. All right. Well, thank you very much, Pamela. And we'll see you next week.
Sounds great. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Astronomy Cast, a nonprofit resource provided by Astrosphere New Media Association, Fraser Kane, and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can find show notes and transcripts for every episode at astronomycast.com. You can email us at info@astronomycast.com. Tweet us at astronomycast. Like us on Facebook or circle us on Google+. We record our show live on Google+, every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, or 2000 Greenwich Mean Time. If you missed the live event, you can always catch up over at cosmoquest.org. If you enjoy Astronomy Cast, why not give us a donation? It helps us pay for bandwidth, transcripts, and show notes. Just click the donate link on the website. All donations are tax deductible for U.S. residents. You can support the show for free, too. Write a review or recommend us to your friends. Every little bit helps. Click support the show on our website to see some suggestions. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. Our music is provided by Travis Searle, and the show is edited by Preston Gibson.